The contest at Sam Houston Race Park this weekend is shaping up to be one of the better qualifying events of the entire season. 40 entries so far. It's limited to 100, but it's hard to know how many are going to be there. The prizes are guaranteed, though, so you want to keep that in mind. You've got two NHC seats on the line as well as NHC tour points. This is going to be on Saturday. Races consist of all the Houston races, plus Keeneland, Oaklawn, and Santa Anita during the window. So the Wood will be in there, the Bluegrass, and the Santa Anita Derby. For more information, be sure to check out inthemoneypodcast.com/SHRP. Speaking of contests, if you can't be at Sam Houston, you have the opportunity to play in a $1,500 contest over at ExpressBet. It's the Santa Anita Derby Challenge, 100% of entry fees paid out as cash prizes. You can play on track at Santa Anita or online as ExpressBet, as noted. Contest races, all the races at Santa Anita on Saturday. Players must wager at a minimum the whole $1,000 bankroll during the contest. It's going to be a great day, excellent opportunity to get involved and win some seats as well as some cash prizes. To learn more, go to expressbet.com/tournaments. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is our show for Monday, April 1st. No fooling. Peter Thomas Fornital back with you in the Brooklyn bunker once again and joined by a man who's been working 7 days a week for quite a while now with maybe a little bit of a break in sight. You know him from the excellent work he does behind the mic at Sam Houston. Also over here on inthemoneypodcast.com and elsewhere. I'm speaking of Nick Tamaro. Nick, how are things?
Doing great, Pete. Yeah, we're winding down the 7 days a week for working for me with our Sam Houston live racing shifting to Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights during the quarter horse meet. But Keeneland draws their first card today, so it's bad morning line hunting season.
I kind of forgot you have that new, because as if you don't work enough, you now get to endure that. Yes, you're always good about, you tolerate a lot more than I think a lot of people would in terms of cheeky people on social media questioning the Keeneland morning lines. I'm pumped to be heading down there this week. Such a great time of year. Start of baseball and the start of Keeneland, definitely the harbingers for me. But how did the Easter Bunny do down around Houston? Was he a hit this year?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was a good day. We had a nice time. Went to brunch, went to mass, went to brunch. So we did the whole gamut with my daughter in Catholic school now. So she's definitely learning that you can't just pray at the eighth pole. You've got to be a little more active than that. So yeah, it was a good day. I'm sure Perrin enjoyed it as well.
Oh, absolutely. The Easter basket was a hit. We did a little egg hunt. I played with the smoker, made a bunch of food. That was good. Yeah, you can't only be religious at the eighth pole. I think that's a good lesson for a lot of folks out there. Let's look.
I'll tell you who needs God before we get started, and it is our respective baseball teams.
Oh my God, who's worse to start the season? Right? I mean, you at least my team had no expectations.
That was brutal. I mean, this is going on like a five-alarm fire now that they can't win games at Minute Maid. So, and you know, you spend a fortune on a bullpen, and your starters have a 2.28 ERA in a four-game series, and you get swept. That's not pretty.
Just three games, though, to be fair.
Four.
And, oh,
it was a four-game sweep. It was a four-game sweep.
That's frustrating, but it's always – things get so exaggerated at the beginning of the season. You know, if this happens in the middle, it's only the hardcores who are rolling their eyes. When it happens at the beginning of the season, it's the sky is falling. I'm sticking with it. You know, I'm doing this insane – now it really seems insane – promotion for our friends over at Cut, where I'm betting the Mets every day. It's my mettle is going to get tested as we, 3 days in, are down into the near four figures worth of losses. But it'll all turn around, I'm confident. Especially for you guys, less so for the Mets. They could just be terrible, but I think it'll be okay. It's so darn early. Let's talk about these races from Florida, my friend. The big news in racing, of course, the return of fierceness. And I asked this question of JK on the little video we did, YouTube exclusive content. If folks want to go over there and check that out, enter our comment contest maybe on the YouTube page. But fierceness, he is who we thought he was, or is he? Where do you stand on fierceness after that tour de force career best performance in the Florida Derby?
Well, I mean, look, it's important to recognize first and foremost that fierceness did what we felt was possible. You know, we alluded to it in the live stream on Thursday, and I think I kind of felt pretty strongly about it in talking about the race, that he was a lot better than those horses on his best day. And when you give him the opportunity that he had with dictating the pace to everybody else, you know, it's a great example of how this whole notion that, oh, he's better with a target, or oh, she's better with a target, or things like that. Fast horses are better when they're kicking dirt at everybody else. Right, they're going to be more comfortable, they're going to be more relaxed, and John Velasquez is one of the best front end riders the game has ever had. So I felt pretty strongly at about the 5/8 pole that this thing was long over, that it was just going to be basically a matter of how far. And when he really cut him loose around the turn, and he really didn't even cut him loose, I mean, he just started to run away from everybody. It was a very compelling performance, a 110 buyer, one of the better prep races we've seen, I would say, in quite some time. It probably, you have to harken back pretty far to get that kind of effort. Maybe Escondrea in the wood, you know, that kind of effort is what comes to mind. I'm sure there are a few that I'm overlooking in the meantime. California Chrome Santa Anita Derby was very good, but you know, what it leads you to, Pete, is the inevitable conclusion that right now, fierceness is a horse that when things go his way, he's really, really good. And when they don't, he's really, really not. And the Derby is the ultimate race where nothing goes your way and you end up being the survivor of the chaos. And is he going to be able to survive all of that? Will he be able to get himself into a comfortable stalking position without having to go too fast? Or will he, you know, not get shuffled out? Because the one thing that was very clear on Saturday that did not happen in the Holy Bull is he broke like a shot. And he broke with the field, if not he outbroke the field a little bit. And that always is an indicator of a horse that's in form, that's doing well, that's set for a big effort. So, you know, it was great. It was great to see. It was a lot of fun. And now he's a deserving Derby favorite, I think, barring some kind of really tremendous effort from a horse like Sierra Leone or maybe a horse like Dornock. We're going to be dealing with a pretty, you know, pretty solid favorite in fierceness, probably sub 3-1 range as well. And that's a fun thing to have to talk about for the next 5 weeks.
Definitely. Prior to this effort, I was thinking it was a year where, you know, the Derby future bet I wanted was that the winner was going to pay $20 or more. I don't want that bet anymore. I think fierceness has got to be the favorite. I mean, that 110, that's faster than Pharaoh, that's faster than Justify in the preps. So as far as that goes, I do think that's right. I mean, I almost feel like he could be shorter than that. There's some 4-1 around in the UK for our international people. I would say that's kind of an interesting price right now. And I think a lot of people, there may be a little more juice in the price that there should be because of this. You know, look, I get it. It's facile analysis, but I get it. Look at the figures. 95, 59, 105, 84, 110. If you're just, you know, a kid in school trying to pick what number is next in the pattern, it's not, you know, 110 again. It's probably considerably lower than that. But I just don't think that's how horse racing works. And I think that, you know, you made a great point I hadn't even thought about yet, that breaking like a shot, that's not necessarily an accident, right? Being able to break from the gate, get out of there with alacrity, that's a skill in the same way that breaking slowly can indicate being off form or you know, essentially a lack of skill. And I take your point. He seems to need things to go his way, but given what his ideal trip is, going to the lead and staying there, I think it's quite possible he's going to get that trip in the Derby, assuming he can get out of there. A thought that's already occurred to me, and I don't even know if the Kentucky Derby is available for in-race betting around the world in places that allow that kind of thing. But off the bat, this would be a play. My advice to an English person, if there is in running on this, who wanted to bet the Derby, would be watch the first three jumps and then make a decision. Because, yeah, if he gets pinballed again, if if they're, you know, if he doesn't get, if he breaks a half step slow, you know, at that point, that starting price would be an underlay. Whereas if he breaks cleanly, I think whatever his starting price is going to become almost instantly a big overlay, more than the usual favorite who breaks well, even just because it seems like that's the key to the success. And it's not like he had to go overly fast. It's not like he was quarter horse to the lead, but I really appreciated those tactics. And, you know, if he was a horse like the perfect example, Forever Young. So there's a horse that got, you know, another horse that it seems fair to say needs things to go his way. The way the connection spoke about Forever Young after the UAE Derby made it very clear they were concerned about kickback. He had to be ridden in a very certain way to avoid kickback. Being able to repeat that trip in the 20 horse Kentucky Derby, I don't think is nearly as likely as Fierceness being able to repeat his trip, because he's just got to break and go on with it. Where do you stand? Do you think, are you tentatively speaking with or against Fierceness at this point for the Derby test?
I think because of his inability to overcome adversity, you're supposed to be against him at this point. What you have to be particularly concerned with and acutely aware of is what is going to happen in the remaining preps. Is it, and what I mean by that is, how much speed are we going to get in this race? Because yes, the Arkansas Derby result helped him in the sense that nobody who was forwardly placed ran well. We don't have speed coming over from overseas like we've had the last couple of years, even though Dermis Odagake did not show the same speed in the Kentucky Derby that he did in the UAE Derby. Because I think John Velasquez is going to put a very Medina spirit or authentic type of approach to this race. I think he now knows what's under his hands quite well. And this might be a scenario where, ironically, Fierceness being ridden by a guy like Johnny might be a lot more helpful than him being ridden by a guy like Irad, who may have been more inclined to have him stalk. And I think they're just going to go, especially if he's drawn inside the 10. And, you know, at that point, you don't really worry about whether he can overcome adversity as much if he's on the lead. Adversity at that point is just simply going too fast, which, hey, you know what? It's a 20 horse race. A lot of times there's speed and, you know, that slows things down. But I guess what you could be looking at is, you know, a horse like Hades doesn't have enough points. It would be my thought, right? See, he broke poorly, and that definitely changed the complexion of this race, because I think what we all anticipated was that Hades was going to go. I also have to wonder, who the hell was betting Hades at 3-1? Like, that was some of the craziest action I've seen. I get Conquest Warrior. Like, I know why he took money. He still looked like he had a bad case of the slows to me. And he'll end up running a career best buyer figure in here. 86. But still, yeah, of 86, right, was by 2 points. And we sort of know exactly what he is. He won't be headed for the Derby anyway. So, you know, those are the kind of things. I mean, you know, you become concerned with, okay, well, maybe Dornock's going to be in there. Dornock will go, and, you know, that'll put Fierceness on the chase a little bit more. But either way, I think the approach is going to very clearly be, we know what we've got in terms of speed. We know what we have in terms of ability to throw down fractions. And so we're just going to go. We're going to put everybody else on the chase.
That's what I would want to see. I would not be goofing around. Now, it's not to say he can't sit a little tiny bit. It's not like he was hell-bent for leather in the juvenile. He did, like, semi-stalk there. I just think the key is just using that speed. It felt like, and, you know, maybe I didn't give enough credence to the people who talked about the getting bounced around at the beginning of the Holy Bull. Though, again, he ran so poorly there that it was more than one thing that went wrong to have him run so poorly. But I think when you go back and you look at the pace figures when they went with this horse, the good races are when they're good early. And it's really just a question of, you know, having a take no prisoners attitude / just being able to let him run his race. And if somebody else wants to be out there with him, that's fine. It's probably going to tell on them late. As for the rest of the Florida Derby, I think you've already answered this question, but do you see any of the other runners in there, Catalytic, Grandmo the First, potentially being able to hit the board? I certainly cannot imagine you making a case why they're going to reverse form with Fierceness, but could you make a case that they might be good enough to get a little peace come Kentucky Derby?
Yeah, you know, it was a merry-go-round race, Pete. There were really no moves made. It was not as if there was somebody who made any kind of meaningful type of close that would lead you to believe, hey, you know, this horse maybe with a little pace in front of him could get a chunk of it. I did think that Catalytic, all things considered, coming off of LASIK, stretching out, ran well. He kind of ran one speed around there. It was nowhere near what he needed to get close to Fierceness, but it wouldn't, you know, shock me if he was able to run third. Probably a horse that's gradually moving forward. He now gets a lifetime best buyer speed figure by a mile. So he goes from what, 77 to 90. You know, I could say, sure, I could see him getting a piece of it for sure. I imagine he'll go as well. These are his only points, but I think he got 40, so that should be enough to get him in.
That'll be enough.
I wouldn't be shocked by that. Yeah.
What about Grand Mo the First? I mean, probably just too slow, right? The 87 top figure for that Florida Derby effort, running third. And again, probably benefited from the shape of that race where the 1-2-4 early were 1-2-3 on the wire. Underselling him at all? And do you think they'll send him, or do you think they'll await an easier assignment?
I imagine if he has the points to get in, they'll go. You know, these people generally don't pass opportunities to run in it. I think the biggest thing about his effort is that what we all kind of thought, which is that Tampa Derby fig was probably not all that trustworthy, and I think a buyer speed figure would be the first one to tell you that, given the pace of that race, is that in all likelihood that race was 5 to 8 points faster than it came back. So he improved by 5 points. You know, I think that probably matters with regards to judging a horse like Domestic Product, who I believe we're going to see in the wood. And, you know, if he runs better in the wood, then he looks like a really classic clunk up type in the Derby that could easily get a piece of it as well.
Domestic Product, that is.
Domestic Product, yeah. I mean, Grand Mo the First would probably have to improve. But, I mean, look, a neck separated them, and, you know, he was in that photo for second on Saturday, so it's not it wasn't a photo. He was in a photo for third. Catalytic was a pretty clear second. But again, I mean, it was a total merry-go-round race at that point, and you just needed to have the right ones under.
Couple of last thoughts on this. One, Conquest Warrior, you know, maybe too much too soon. You're probably right. The clock indicated that he wasn't fast enough. I kept wanting to let the eye test / the trips he'd had and the hands he was in make me conjure a case where he could improve if Fierceness was much more like the mediocre Fierceness that we'd seen the last day than the good one. That didn't work out. But I'm not willing to give up. I mean, obviously they're not going to press on for the Derby with him. And I almost wouldn't. I don't know what I'd do with him, honestly, if I were calling the shots, but I don't want to give up on him as a late summer horse when he develops and maybe he can get a little bit faster, because I do think he has talent. And then I think you made a key point about one really interesting thing about the Florida Derby and the Arkansas Derby, just all the form clues we're getting about the previous prep races. So now look, Ladonbro ran so bad. He obviously just didn't run his race at all, but it is, you know, certainly doesn't do a lot for Dornock's form going forward. And regarding Fierceness, you know, I've gone all the way there and back again now with this BC juvenile form, with Muth coming back and being as successful as he was. That juvenile really is looking now like that really key piece of form, as opposed to, you know, when Fierceness came back and ran so badly, it was like, well, was he maybe flattered by the track, by the pace, by something that day? No, I think we can feel really good about how that race is shaking out. And I think you're right, Grandmother First gives Domestic Product a very interesting form boost, and we'll talk more about that as we get closer to the wood. We're going to be having, obviously, loads of coverage of all the big racing next Saturday. Let's take a second and talk about Arkansas. Obviously, I'll ask you, minimal Derby implications from this one. Is it fair to say?
Yeah, you know, maybe some Triple Crown implications, right? But no, yes. No huge amount of Derby implications, of course, with Muth winning. And here's a totally unrelated and sort of idiotic question. What is the origin of the name Muth?
I forget what it means in Arabic, but I think it means, I think that's where it comes from. You know, Amir has a lot of those cultural references in his names. And I think I've heard it, but I honestly, I'm not able to pull it off the top of my memory. Maybe I'll take a quick look. If we don't know it now, we'll certainly hear it before wherever he next appears, presumably the Preakness. Is that what they're saying for him?
You know, Baffert was a little noncommittal. I think if you read between the lines, he's probably waiting to see what happens next week, and he might just choose between the Preakness and Belmont with his squadron of horses. So, I mean, I assume that he's going to have Maymoon and Impressionism still yet to run. Wind Me Up, obviously, is a horse that's going to run somewhere as well. So, Maymoon just worked for the fourth time since his last race. So he'll run somewhere. And – Yeah, I mean, I guess it'll just be a matter of who goes where, right? Who goes to the Preakness, who goes to the Belmont? But yeah, they'll end up going in both places. I didn't know if maybe the way Frank Miramati called the horse's name, if it had something to do with the tight end for the Steelers. I didn't know if Zidane was a Steelers fan, but yeah, I don't know.
Possible. Anything's
It's possible.
possible.
I mean,
It's
when Pat
international.
Freiermuth catches a pass, they go move. And so, you know, Frank did that one time. I guess I could just ask Frank, but
Ask Frank what he thinks about that. There, muta is an Arabic word that means pleasure. So I don't know. I listen sometimes. If you happen to be tuning into this show, let us know where the name comes from. We're overdue for a catch up anyway. He's always fun to chat with out in the mornings. To just a real passionate fan of the game who's brought a lot of other people in as well on the ownership side. So JK on the video we did for the new top 10 was actually he's bullish on, you know, and he, like me, you know, very guided by speed figures. He was ready to start talking about fierceness again as a potential Triple Crown horse based on the brilliance he'd shown. But I think the biggest monkey wrench in that works might, many would say the biggest monkey wrench in that hypothesis is the lack of consistency that fierceness has shown. I might argue that the biggest wrench in the works might be the Baffert flotilla of horses that's going to be waiting for him in two separate waves come Preakness and Belmont. What's your gut on that idea of fierceness as a potential Triple Crown winner?
Yeah, two issues. One is Baffert, one is Pletcher. Right, one is
Right.
the Baffert being the bigger issue is that he's got live strong horses ready for those two legs, and the other part is, I mean, Todd has shown no, I mean, he's shown very little willingness at this point, let alone ability to have horses come back that quickly. Maybe, you know, designing Fierceness's spring around, giving him a break between those first two races of 2024 was with an eye on that. But, you know, I think for a guy like Todd, so much of the attention is on getting a horse to the Derby that bringing them back in 2 weeks. It seems tough to believe that he'd be ready for, you know, the likes of Muth or Maymoon or horses like that on a 2 week turnaround. But, you know, you never know. It is at least part of the conversation. I will say to your point about you making the over under on winning mutual of a Derby horse $20. Fierceness's race on Saturday increased the number of horses that would pay over $20. No
Yeah.
question about that. So you actually end up with more, you end up with more numbers, but
Yeah, more.
probably less of a chance.
I think that's exactly right. Let's talk about some of the other horses coming out of Arkansas. Just Steel, tough horse we've spent a lot of time talking about throughout the spring, gets second at 32-1 coming off of the disappointing try in the Rebel. You know he'll be going to the Kentucky Derby. Does he have a chance to hit the board in your imagining?
You know, interesting to hear Wayne Lucas say that Keith Asmussen is going to keep them out, and he's had some success with Keith. And you know, it's pretty. If you had bet the prop of who would train the first horse that Keith Asmussen rode in the Derby, it would be a very, very, very heavy favorite of Steve Asmussen. But ironically, Eric Asmussen got his first stakes win at Sam Houston, and it was not for Steve. So both of them are showing that they are capable. And you know, Just Steel is a hard knocking, hard trying horse. He's really easy to like. I could see him clunking up for a piece of it, maybe not much more so than a piece of the first half of the field. The horse that you, to me, that you want to take away from there that's Derby eligible, that did something was Mystic Dan, because he made really the only meaningful off the pace move. He didn't have the cleanest of trips. So he had to deal with some adversity. He's already in the field. So really, I mean, this part of this was just for schooling purposes. And it ended up that, that he ran well, all things considered. So I would say I could see myself warming up to him a little bit. You know, he is a horse, he's a one number kind of horse in the sense that his one like super big race was up a gold rail. But you know, understandably so, he at least validated it with a fair effort despite some trouble. So I would say those are the ones that you want to kind of take away with some positives. The horse that you can't come away with anything but a really sour feeling on is Timberlake. And you know, now you have to be incredibly concerned about the distance limitations that everybody had hinted at with regards to Timberlake, because it looks as if he is really going to struggle at distances probably beyond a mile and a 16th to a mile and an eighth. And I know I wanted to give him an opportunity after the Rebel to prove it, and unfortunately he proved it the wrong way.
Right. JK's beating the drum already for the Jerkins for Timberlake. You think that's about the right way to go?
I agree. I think probably a little bit shorter. I could see, Brad looking at the Dwyer and maybe going like a bit of a Saudi Crown type route. Saudi Crown hadn't even debuted at this point in time last year. We were actually at Keeneland the day he debuted. And so I could see him going that route. I actually, we touched on Conquest Warrior a little bit earlier. I think Conquest Warrior is a sprinter as well. I think he's an interesting cutback, and he's got a very sprint heavy dam side. So yep, I could see Timberlake being better on the cutback, maybe miler type, and can just be effective doing that. He didn't get the cleanest of runs, kind of having to move a little bit early, but it felt like even halfway down the backstretch, Muth was just going to take him whenever he was ready to, and he pretty much did.
Conquest Warrior, maybe a future Met Mile type horse, not this year, but in the future, if he develops, could you see him being of that quality, or am I elevating him, his potential?
I could. I mean, he's going to have to get better, but he's still only what, four starts in. So, I mean, it's tricky, Pete, because these horses run so infrequently that, forecasting how much better they could get seems like a fool's errand sometimes. If we were able to actually see them run more frequently, we could get a sense of it. I think the problem that Conquest Warrior ran into was that because he's trained by Shug, he was automatically very popular, and the assumption was, oh, well, he'll get the distance because it's Shug. But, I mean, even a guy like Shug can't figure out how to get 9 furlongs out of a sprinter.
No, that's exactly right. He's not a magician. He's a great horseman. there are limits to what
big difference.
That's a great point about the dam side of that pedigree too. That's where they, the potential he's shown. I definitely a horse I want to keep on side, but I do think rerouting him obviously away from these toughest tests of the spring for the 3-year-olds going long is probably the right move. Let's talk a little bit about Dubai. We'll start with the horse I mentioned already, Forever Young. You could probably read my skepticism, and part of it was having Toshi Onokubo, who does work for us on the JRA side and is a pal, doing the translating and talking about that unusual headgear the horse wore, and hearing from connections that part of the purpose of that headgear was to lessen the impact of kickback because they think he hates it. It just, as fast as that race looks like it probably was, and I didn't do any real work on this, Nick, and I doubt you've looked at it. We'll have more info about what that figure was. I'm guessing it's going to probably be somewhere around 100. Like, it's going to be a fast number. It's going to be a very fast number. It's not going to be as fast as the fastest numbers of, not going to be close to the fastest number of Fierceness. In an ordinary year, I feel like it's the kind of number that would give him some sort of a shot. But I think that the combination of now having a standout favorite in Fierceness and concerns about kickback ahead of the Kentucky Derby, I'm probably not. I did bet Derma last year. I'm probably not going to be betting Forever Young come the Kentucky Derby. What did you think of his effort?
Yeah, I mean, that seems fair. I've got to do a little bit more work on this horse. I probably was more familiar at this point in time last year with Derma Sotogake than I am with Forever Young, admittedly. So, but yeah, I mean, I think, looking at form lines, he probably seems like a bit more modest type, but I'm going to die on the hill of the Japanese winning this race one at some point. And I just, it's going to be a matter of when, not if. So he's probably going to have to overcome a little bit more adversity than at least we thought a horse like Derma Sotogake would, because of how much more forwardly placed I think we all anticipated Derma Sotogake would be. So yeah, I mean, I don't have a strong lean one way or the other. I would say that right now he probably is going to have to run a little bit better than he has in order to win.
Only have you for a couple more minutes today, so we're going to give short shrift to the non-3-year-old action from March 30th. But I'll just throw open an open question, whether you want to talk about Dubai or the big card at Florida, any other runners in particular who impressed you coming out of Saturday's stakes action?
Well, I mean, the other horse that's worth mentioning is not a Derby horse, but Mindframe was a tremendously impressive debut winner of the fifth race on Saturday. Got a 103 buyer speed figure. Yeah, so he feels like Matt Bernier kind of mapped out a schedule for him that included the Peter Pan and potentially the Belmont. He feels like a horse that, you would imagine the connections are going to want to try and figure out how to get him going long. He's a Constitution out of a Street Sense mare that went for 600,000 at the Keeneland September sale, which was probably a bargain from Micropoli's perspective. And so, yeah, he felt like a horse that'll be really interesting. The Gulfstream Oaks was a race that sort of derailed a lot of my multi-race action, but was won by power squeeze with Ways and Means finishing a good second. You know, it'll be interesting to me to see what Chad does with Ways and Means and if he wants to run her back in the Oaks. Brian Natto interviewed him after he won the Orchid and said, you know, this is not a typical type of move for you to bring a horse back at this distance. And he basically said, no, you're right, it's not. But she was training so well that I wanted to give her every opportunity to get to the Oaks. And I didn't really love the ride that she got. I thought she was like really kind of shoved into the race over and over by Irad and really asked to make a prolonged move. And, you know, I could see her as a really big, like, forward jumping horse second off the layoff.
Sure.
So I would imagine she'll go. I don't really know if we're going to get any kind of price. I mean, she's going to be one of the favorites, but she could be really interesting in there because, you know, they sped off six lengths clear of everybody else. They got a 90. She got a 90 buyer. Power Squeeze got a 92. And Power Squeeze was a filly who obviously is very good at Gulfstream and has really come into her own of late for Jorge Delgado. How much her game will travel, we'll see. But I thought Ways and Means ran a really credible race, and I was pleased to see it because she was a filly who we obviously saw last year with a lot of talent, and she might just be an Oaks player.
Superstar potential for sure. We can't let this show finish without a couple other words about what we saw at Dubai. And we'll start with Laurel River and this extremely impressive win in the Dubai World Cup. What did you make of this, and what do you think will be next for this one?
Well, so my understanding, and again, I have this all secondhand. I'm not any kind of insider, but Laurel River is going to have a difficult time getting into races in America because I'm pretty sure he's on like every vets list in this country. So based on him not being able to run in the Breeders' Cup in 2022, and clearly a different horse appeared on Saturday in Dubai. And so we'll see if Judmont is able to get him back over here and get him into some of the big races here. Look, I mean, he's a horse that we knew had a tremendous amount of talent. He was going to be one of the favorites in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile in 2022. He clearly took a step forward in the Burj Nahar. The problem with this card on a yearly basis is that we very frequently end up dealing with a huge inside speed bias, and Saturday night was not a huge exception. It wasn't maybe quite as big as it had been, but once he cleared the field, it was just, you know, it was a fait accompli from there. So I don't want to shortchange his performance, but, you know, these races on this card have a tendency to leave us with a little bit of a disappointed feeling, or, you know, a little sour. And so I kind of felt a little bit of that, but, you know, credit to him and the connections for having him ready and taking advantage of his natural speed, because it really played out favorably.
Last but not least, a quick shout out to Rebels Romance, former Breeders' Cup Turf winner. There was a lot of support for the other Breeders' Cup Turf winner in the form of Auguste Rodin, but he's another one, not unlike Fierceness, who's been known to run the occasional clunker. That's what we got from him. Rebels Romance looked to be getting back to top form and certainly seems like a candidate to come over to these shores before too long.
Yeah, I can't do the thing where one eyebrow goes up and one stays the same, but this was a result where that would kind of happen because it was like, okay, we saw Rebels Romance last year. That's not the Rebels Romance that we saw in 2023. And, you know, forgive me for speaking out of turn, but sometimes there are these results on this night with horses that whose jockeys have blue on, and you're like, okay, that was that one. So anyway, he ran well. And again, I'm a fan of Rebels Romance because I love seeing international participation in our, you know, quote, run-of-the-mill races like the Bowling Green. So I'm all for it. I want to see Charlie Appleby send horses over here, not only because they've run particularly well in the past, but at times because they've not, right? And they end up creating a ton of value in some of these races where he enters.
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, obviously the one disappointment last year was the rider got dumped, but then the other one was, yeah, well beaten at 1-2.
It was in a bog. Right, yeah. Right. It was in a box, so I don't want to hold it against him. And Warlike Goddess obviously is a very good horse, but the fact that he couldn't catch so high for third was like, okay, that's not very good. But
it was not great. It was not great by any stretch of the imagination.
It was that prep race in the His Highness the Emir Trophy. That was the one that did it.
I'll remember next year on this day, we can't do 30 minutes. We need the whole hour to get through everything in proper fashion. But hopefully we've whetted the appetite. We're going to have a ton more content on the channel this week. A lot of it looking forward, especially with Keeneland coming up. But I've got a guest waiting in the green room, Nick. So for now, I will let you go, and we will pick it up real soon.
Sounds great, my friend. Talk soon.
quick reminder that this is the week on the calendar where if you sign up for In the Money Plus, you can get all of our Keeneland coverage, and we're going to have a lot extra. Eric DeCoster with Diaries on the weekend. Will Humphrey, who's been doing great work for us, is going to also be adding trends pieces and horses to follow for the middle of the weekdays. There's going to be a lot of great stuff on there, as well as our entire Derby package. If you sign up now, we'll have a list soon of everything that's going to be involved in that. But $20, you get it all. Great time to sign up for In the Money Plus, inthemoneypodcast.com/plus. Next up on the show, we have a bit of a departure from our usual content on this In the Money Players podcast. This is going to be a segment about a new book. You know how we like to highlight books from time to time, particularly from people in our horse racing orbit. And that's what we're going to be doing here, is we bring in a man who a lot of people might know from the fantastic work he does for America's Best Racing / the Jockey Club. And this is about a really poignant memoir that has just been released. It's attracting a lot of attention. I encourage folks to get a copy and read it as soon as possible. The book is Walk On by Stephen Panis, who joins us today. Stephen, how are you hanging in there, man?
I'm doing all right, Peter. How about you?
I'm doing really well, and I'm feeling very inspired today because reading this book has been more than just the normal experience in reading a memoir. And, you know, warning to listeners, it's not the easiest topic. It starts in a very traumatic place, depressing place even, I'll go ahead and say, but it very quickly transforms and changes into something much more inspirational than that those first few sentences would have you believe. How has the process gone so far in talking about this book? And you've been doing a ton of media for it. Has it been rewarding?
Yes, it's meaningful because it keeps me connected to my son, who passed away nearly 4 years ago in a tragic car accident. And this process of writing and writing the book and talking to the media about it and getting the word out and trying to help others is also about really just allowing me to continue to be his father and to take him on a journey that he would have been doing had he been here, and just honoring his enduring legacy of lifting up others and spreading joy.
But you capture those ideas perfectly in the book. And it really, again, the word that I keep coming back to is inspiration that I feel reading it. I want to ask you, I probably will before this interview is over, ask you some parenting questions, because I think there's a lot of insight. And so what you say about this process being a continuation of being a parent to him, as well as a parent to your other son, it really resonates with me. We have a lot of trouble in our society talking about grief. It's not something that is often done outside of intimate relationships. And I think another thing that the book did before reading the book, I was almost like, well, you know, I know this book is going to be good because I've known Stephen for a long time and we'll figure out a way to talk about it. But I became much more comfortable with the idea of getting into sort of the nitty gritty of your experience in the way that you lay it out in the book. Has that been a process for you? Has it gotten a little bit easier over time, specifically talking about your own grief? It
takes time, for sure. It's a process. I started writing this book purely as survival initially. I was struggling, and I openly admit that. I think anybody who loses a child and loses a child suddenly with no warning is traumatized on some of the most epic levels a human body can go through. And eventually, I got to a point where my writing was just puke, right? I was just putting stuff on paper, and yes, it made me feel better, but it also hurt. And I had to take long breaks from writing the book. But eventually I got to a point where I realized what the message, and I wasn't writing a book, I was just writing. But then I realized that there was something greater that could be there if I really dug deep and leaned into it. And the Buddhists say that you have to lean into the sharp points if you want to be able to deal with the suffering of life, if you will. And so I started to lean in and really put it down and share a story that's Jake's story, as much as my journey through it. And grief, let me just say that grief is a personal journey. My wife and I and our youngest son, Liam, who was 11 at the time, we all suffered a great loss, but we each deal with it totally differently and on our own terms and our own shape and manner. And that's just the way grief is, but you do need support from others. And we support one another, which is crucial. But that journey is a solo flight, man. It's just you and your soul. And the one thing I did learn in doing a lot of reading is that the bison is the only known animal that will turn into a storm. And the reason they do that is it's the shortest way through the storm. And that really left a mark on me when I read it. And that's kind of when I turned into my own personal storm and said, if I want to get through this, I have to accept it, which is incredibly hard at the beginning. Accept that my son's gone forever and it's never coming back, and accept that my life is forever changed, and figure out what am I going to do with my life and how am I going to, the only thing I control is what I do and what I feel about what happened. And it became that simplified.
That's a very powerful message you share very specifically in the book. And that's a terrific thing I hadn't even thought about is the even within a family unit, the individual journey that you have to go on. I've never even taken courses in human psychology, but boy, does it really resonate with me that whatever your individual approach is, that idea of having to feel something to integrate it in your life, as opposed to falling prey. And I've done this many times in my life in difficult situations where you fall prey to the culture of avoidance and distraction that we live in. I think when you're dealing with a loss so profound, that's not going to get you very far. And this very brave approach that you're describing would be the one that would give you the ability to deal with loss. And I say deal with loss and not heal from loss. Cause I also thought in the book you made an important observation that reminded me of the most helpful thing that I heard when my father passed away 10 years ago. I think I asked someone who'd lost his father 5 years before something to the effect of, does this wound ever heal? And he, in a loving way, like almost chuckled at the very notion of it healing. He said, laughed at that idea in a loving way, but said, mm-hmm. You don't heal, but you do scar over and you learn to continue. Does that resonate with the experience you're going through?
Yeah, it does. There's a void. And just like you have a void in your life, Peter, and I'm sorry about your father's passing. I recall, reading about it and reading the stories. And he certainly left a great legacy for you and your family. But that's a void, right? And you just had Easter, and I'm sure you thought about your dad, right?
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, the people that we're close to and that really leave a mark on our life, that mark is always there. And you feel it. It's tangible. Holidays are difficult for us. We're only, like I said, just shy of 4 years into this process. But they also, that void also can bring back smiles at the right times. True. And laughter and great memories. And at the end of the day, that's all we have, right? Is we have our memories, our great moments and shared times. And that's it. I mean, you got to find a way to walk on. And it's not easy, but it's possible.
I wanted to ask you the biggest difference I would imagine for this particular type of loss from the type of loss that I was describing is, you lose a parent, it follows a natural order of things, as awful as it is. The idea of this in your life happening in an unnatural order, that must be among the most difficult parts and the nuances of the grief that were very hard for you to deal with. And I mean, I admire you so much for, and we'll get into some of the specifics of how you did this, but trying to take that pain and turn it into something as positive as you could do. But am I right that wrinkle makes this type of grief different than the norm, quote unquote, normal grief that happens in the natural order of things?
Without question. I mean, you never, ever, as a parent, contemplate that you're going to bury one of your children. It's just, you won't allow your mind go to that.
Yeah,
and rightfully
so.
Yeah, it's our worst nightmare. And when it does happen, we're conditioned, or our brains seek out logical reasoning for things. Why did this happen? And I'll never get a why in this lifetime. But it doesn't stop you from chasing it initially. It could be because you want answers. And as a father, and I write about this, as a father, we're taught in society that we're supposed to protect our families, and we're most especially our children, right? Our young children. And I realized through this process that that's an illusion. We all think we have protective guard over our children, but at the end of the day, I sent my son away on a weekend trip with his girlfriend's family, and I entrusted the care to the girlfriend's mom. And unfortunately, that chain was broken. But I sent my son away to sports camp and school and summer camp and other weekend getaways with his friends, and he always came home. So you have that concept of, oh, I control it, but I quickly learned that you don't, and it is just an illusion that no parent really wants to think about. But it's hard, it's really hard to accept it. Like I said, it took a long time for me to accept it, and when I sometimes I still, have to remind myself that he's gone to kind of fully embrace it. And I say embrace it, but it's a way for me to move on.
Sure. I think that the reality is, if you had, and I'm sure your mind goes down these rabbit holes. You mentioned in the book at some point, you say, oh, maybe I shouldn't have let him go on that trip. But I mean, thinking of this realistically, if you had tried to take that level of control over his life, it would be really very irrational and borderline, crazy to try to do that. And he wouldn't have been able to become, with that level of attempted protectiveness, it probably doesn't work anyway. You're still at mercy of a million things you can't even think of, for one thing. But then for another thing, how could he have grown into the character that he was? I refer to character because I know him from the pages in the book. I mean, just what strikes me so much about Jake as a character is his confidence and compassion. You can't develop those things if your parent is worried about you crossing the street.
Right. You can't bubbleize your kid. And we certainly didn't. And you do have to expose them to things, and you trust the process of life. And you never contemplate something like this is ever going to happen. And when it does, it sends your body into just the most traumatic shock ever. But through this process, I did learn, and I think it's really important to talk about, is that our vulnerability is our strength. And the minute that I was able to recognize that and honor it in a way that I started to live it out, which is be open with my feelings, which is not easy for a man. We're trained not to cry. We're trained not to talk about our feelings. But when this happened, I was blown to smithereens.
Of course.
And I needed help, and I got therapy, and I'm still in therapy. And I wouldn't be here without it. So I think owning the fact that we can think we're strong as rocks, when something like this happens to you, you will shatter into a million different pieces, and you're going to need help, and you're going to need to talk to someone who's a professional. Most likely, it's not for everyone, but I think it certainly helps everyone if they're open to it. And you're going to learn to kind of reassess your life and figure out what's important, what matters most. And you realize that you can really winnow that list down. When you realize you don't have this control that you think you have, you can winnow that list down to a handful of things.
I had on my list of things to ask you about the grief therapy that you went through and how helpful you found that. Tell me a little bit more about the specifics of who your therapist is and how you were able to find him.
Yeah, so we got lucky. My wife had been searching for a therapist, and a good friend put us in touch with a woman out of Boston. My wife's originally from Boston, and we met with her. She's not a therapist. She's just she's more like an astrological reader. And she was a good friend of my wife's maid of honor. And we were talking to her, and she read Jake's chart. And we were just, again, seeking answers, right? You want to know, like, was this in his chart? Was something supposed to happen? You want to grasp onto anything. And in talking to her, she was incredibly kind and compassionate. And she said, I have a really good friend. He's a grief therapist, and he's internationally renowned. And I don't know if he has space, but I'm going to call him right now. And his name is Mitch Davidowitz. He's out of Arlington, Mass. He's a master therapist. And we've been blessed that our paths crossed. I now look to him as like almost like a father figure. We've become friends, if that's possible, sure. you know, with your therapist. But he's someone that I can just freely share my feelings with, my deepest concerns, my pain points, and he can provide objective counsel. And just he helped usher us through some really challenging times because the first 2 years were beyond painful. In fact, the second year might have been even harder than the first for varying different reasons. But he has been there like for us at every turn. And I could, like I said, I continue to meet with him once a week to this day. And it just proved, it was like a lifeline, honestly. I don't know. I don't think my wife would have made it for sure without Mitch. And then also as a couple, because again, like I said, we grieve completely differently. We share the same tragedy, but we're on different train tracks and occasionally we cross, but thankfully we're able to support each other. And we do couples therapy as well, because this is something like this happening can destroy many marriages. We were warned about that.
For
and
sure.
We were adamant that we weren't going to let that happen to us, no matter how much anger we had at the beginning. And we didn't even recognize each other for months. We were zombies. And so thankfully, he's just been like a total game changer, lifesaver for us.
One of my favorite aspects of the book is all the wisdom you pull in from these wildly diverse sources. Some of them are from the world of sports, some are from, you know, French philosophy. You really do a great job of finding wisdom all over the place. And I think, you know, the reason you, I assume, went down some of the rabbit holes to find these messages was your belief in the power of words to heal. And that's something that I wanted to underline, because I don't want people to think that when you read this book, it's going to be, yes, there's aspects of it where you're following along on a punishing journey, but the book for the reader is not a punishing journey at all. There's so much inspiration to be found through this wisdom from the world of so many different places that you were able to pull together, and things that must have helped you that you're now sharing with the readers. To me, that's one of the best reasons for people to read Walk On, is to be able to experience that, this like curated wisdom, if you will, from you. How did that process for you start, of looking for those words with the power to heal, if you will?
It started because when you lose a child, your whole belief system is blown to smithereens. You don't, your value system, you question everything. You don't know what to trust, who to trust. And when I started to look inward and look at Liam, my surviving 11-year-old son, I said, I needed to be there for him as a father, or what good was I, right? He was struggling. He lost his best friend, his older brother, who he adored and revered. And he's a kid. And I'm looking at myself. I was 51 when this happened. And my soul was crushed and I was unrecognizable. And I'm thinking, if I'm this bad, what the hell is an 11-year-old boy supposed to do with this? I knew that moment that I had to be there for Liam, no matter how broken I was, and to show him that there was a pathway through this hell, and that I would be there with him every step of the way, and we would get through this together, and that he held his future in his hand, and teaching him that we didn't control a lot, but what we did control, which is our beliefs and what we do about what happens to us. And then my belief system was just completely upset, I looked back at a tradition I had with my boys, where when Jake was five, I started writing inspiring messages on post-it sticky notes on a daily basis to him, that I would, a Fick lunch bag or to the island. And he would read them before school. And they came from, like you said, they came from a host of different known and unknown personalities. Sometimes they were my own messages. The goal was, I wanted to set him on a path to leading a life with deep meaning, with values and characteristics that would serve him well in life. And so I did that for years. And when Liam was old enough to read, it continued with him. He got added to the yellow sticky note. And but when Jake died, I started looking back at those. My wife had saved a lot of the sticky notes, I hadn't realized. And my mother, God bless her, had being how sweet she is, she actually transcribed a lot of them. And so I I started looking back at them and I had to make sense of them because I was like, what the hell does this, this doesn't mean that, you know, like where's the truth in this stuff, right? I needed to revisit those for not just myself and Jake, for Liam, and I had to make sense of them. And that's kind of what the book is, where it goes, is that I take these characteristics and values and traits that I think are important if you want to lead a noble life and be the best version of yourself. And I talk about them in the context of grief and just how I could walk on from this tragedy.
From Viktor Frankl to Lou Holtz to John Wooden, there's so much wisdom in this book that's going to resonate with its readers. I know you received a lot of outreach from people of all different walks of life that you knew in various contexts. There were a couple specific ones I wanted you to share with the readers, again, to give a little bit of an idea of the journey that folks go on with you in the book. One was from a neighbor who was a nonagenarian at the time. Do you know the one I'm referring
yep,
to?
Yep, yep.
If you'd share that story, that would be very cool.
Yeah, so we received a handwritten letter days after Jake passed. It was a beautiful letter. It was initially hard to read because it was old cursive style. And we had no idea who it wasn't. The envelope didn't contain a name, and it just had a first name. And we had no idea who wrote this letter, but he generously shared his heart with us, he shared that he had lost two children, both in car accidents about 6 months apart, about 40 or 50 years ago. And he'd served in World War One or Two, excuse me. And he went on to lead a really rich life. It did cost him his first marriage when he lost the children, but he rebounded from that, remarried. And it turned out that his wife was a yoga student of my wife's. My wife is a yoga teacher. She was bringing us flowers and we were able to connect the dots. And then he asked if he could come over. And so he came over one day. He was about 97 years old. And we sat outside. He gingerly walked across our bridge. We have a little bridge across the stream. And we sat outside. And it was one of the most powerful sit-downs I've ever had in my life with a fellow human being. He just opened up himself to us, listened a lot to us, but he shared some real great wisdom. And the pain in his eyes, I mean, he lost his kids, like I said, in the early 70s. When he talked, it might as well have been yesterday. And he was just totally there for us in a way. We developed a friendship and went over and had lunch with he and his wife several times. And sadly, he passed away months later. But he had lived a full life. And he went on to do great things, tried to enjoy every moment that he could, living in the present moment. And he just set such a great example. He was like a bright light that we needed in a time of real darkness.
Great description. I want you to talk about Shane Beamer's role in this story.
Yeah, so 2 days before Christmas, months after Jake had died, I got a phone call, and I had left my phone at home, and I was out for a walk, and I came back in, and there was a message. I went to the University of South Carolina, so I got a lot of friends down in the South Carolina area, and I had a message from an 843 number, and I thought, oh, it's someone trying to cheer me up, right, you know, 2 days before Christmas. And I played it, and lo and behold, it was the newly hired head football coach, Shane Beamer, at the University of South Carolina. And he had heard about what happened to Jake, wanted to reach out. And I called him back, and he was actually on another line trying to hire a coach. He had only been on the job for 2 weeks. So he's trying to hire a coach, recruit, keep recruits at the school, everything one needs to do when onboarding, you know, at a new program. And we ended up, he said, I'll call you back. And he called back, he FaceTimed back, and Liam and I spoke to him, and he couldn't have been any more kind. And the humanity that he showed for and concern for Liam was, it really struck me. It reminded me, he was like Jake was with Liam. And it really left a mark. We became friends from that phone call. And I had attended the University of South Carolina, graduated in 91. Jake was obviously raised on SEC football in South Carolina and all things Gamecocks. And he wanted to go there. I'd take him down a couple of times for games, had a great time. And that was his dream school. He wanted to go there and experience it. And as his father, I had been contemplating, how can I get my son there? And I was considering some different scholarship ideas. And after striking the friendship up with Shane, it struck me that this is the best way I can do that, is to create this scholarship that would honor a walk-on football player that exhibits many of the leadership qualities that Jake had. And so I called Shane with the idea and he loved it. And Shane was a fellow walk-on, so he certainly embraced the idea and understood the meaning and everything behind it. And he couldn't have been any greater. And it put us in contact with the athletic department, and we quickly raised the funds and have an endowed scholarship there now, the Jake Panis Walk-On Scholarship. We've given 3 scholarships away at the University of South Carolina over the last 3 years to walk-on football players. Great kids, all of them. I stay in touch with them. And then prior to that, we had launched a scholarship in South Dakota at Red Cloud Indian School, which is on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, one of the poorest areas in the country. And we've awarded 3 scholarships there, also named the Jake Panis Walk-On Scholarship, 3 young Lakota women who are first-generation college students now.
Great.
And that's stuff that Jake, you know, when I award those scholarships, Peter, it's so meaningful. I see the joy in the kids' faces. I see Jake in their faces. They understand the responsibility that's bestowed upon them, that they now carry that baton, and they need to, you know, pass on the kindness to people that they now encounter in their life and create that ripple of kindness that creates echoes. It's powerful, and it gave my life new meaning when I didn't have any.
Paying it forward, as it were, and Walk On, the perfect title for this book, not least because of its double meaning, which you explain in the pages. It's actually more like a triple meaning, I suppose. But I want you to explain to the listeners why that's such the perfect title.
Yeah, so everyone knows what a walk-on student athlete is. They're not on scholarship, and they have to earn their way on with their performance. They're on the scout team. They take a beating usually. They were the kids that maybe were undervalued, overlooked, came from a smaller school program. But there's a lot of them that do earn scholarships and earn their way on because they have the skills, they have the leadership characteristics, et cetera. And then in Native American lore, the term walk-on means that it's just your next step in your journey. And that's what Jake did. And when we learned that, I didn't know that when we started the scholarships. When I learned that, it just felt like the universe had tied it all together in a unique way for us. And so that's the meaning. And for me, it's the ability, you know, no matter what happens to us or how it happens, we all suffer and we all have to find a way to walk on in our lives.
That's it. That's perfectly described. I want to talk a little bit more about Jake as a character, specifically his service-minded attitude that ties back in to the scholarships for the Lakota women. And as a parent, this interests me because I, Stephen, have recently accepted the fact that I can't spoil my child and then get upset with her for being spoiled, to oversimplify. Yep. it seemed like this was something that you had a solution for. I'm going to go ahead and suggest. And just as a parent, I want to hear more about how you helped him develop that service-minded attitude that he had.
So Jake was a magnetic personality. I'll start with that. He was the type of kid, he walked into a room and you knew it. You felt his energy. You saw him. He had a beautiful golden curls afro that men and women were jealous of. he had a big smile on his face, and he was an extrovert of epic proportions. He loved people, loved gatherings. The more the merrier was Jake's mantra. But we raised our boys to understand that, you know, we're all connected and we have to help one another, and giving back to your community is big. Never forgetting where you're from is important. And his church played a big role in his life. And in his freshman year of high school, his church youth group goes out to South Dakota. The senior high youth group goes out there every summer and spends time teaching the young children out there life skills, reading, math, how to do basic life things, and just shares love, you know, and joy with them. They come from, sadly, some really tough life circumstances. The poverty is abject out there. It's troubling to see. Honestly, I've been out there. They're beautiful people, and the land is beautiful. The conditions are beyond rough. And when Jake went there, he came home deep affected by that experience. And he recognized the incongruities with how he lived and how they lived, what he had available to him and what they didn't. And it didn't sit well with him. And honestly, as his father, I was really pleased to see that he was able to recognize that disparity, but more proud that he wanted to do something about it. He was like, "Dad, we got to help these people." And he couldn't wait to get back. Unfortunately, COVID canceled that 2020 trip. And then he died 2 months later. So we knew right away, instead of getting more flowers, that the first fund we raised money for was, and let me say this, the first fund was the scholarship out in Pine Ridge, and the horse racing community, I can't thank them enough, Peter. They rallied and donated on epic levels, and this scholarship is now endowed. It will live forever. And these kids, it's game-changing for these kids who, again, are first generation going to college. It's so powerful. It's so meaningful. And my heart, forever grateful to each and everyone in the horse racing community who reached out in their own way and supported this and continues to support it. I can't thank them enough. It's outstanding when you see a community rally like that, and it meant the world to us.
That's very cool. And what an appropriate and amazing way for his legacy to continue in perpetuity, no less. Wonderful idea and execution born out of his own real life experiences. One of the other things you talk about throughout the book are various tools and attributes that you've used in your journey. You describe how your life is forever split into a two-act play, and the idea of grace and grit being two of the tools that you've been able to use. I wanted to ask you to expound a little bit more on what grace and grit have meant to you during this time in your life.
Well, I think we all need grit, no matter what happens to us. Grit is your inner fortitude, your resilience, and we all have it. It's a muscle. We just have to exercise it. And I think there isn't anybody in this life that isn't affected by something. I joke now that I look around and I can see everyone's invisible backpack. You know, we all carry some form of suffering. We're dealing with something, a friend or family member dealing with something, and we're stressed about it or worried or have anxiety, or if we don't have our own personal issue. And so having that, the grit is so necessary, just because that's what it takes to crawl out from tough circumstances. I could have crawled into a ball and stayed in the darkness, or I could move towards the light. And that's what I did. I thankfully had hope, but grit was the one of the main characteristics that helped me get through this. That no matter what, I believed that I could. You just have to, cannot underestimate resilience, and it's such a critical part of life. Because again, we all experience it, and grief comes in many forms. This is not just someone dying, right? You could lose your job, your marriage fails, or a relationship goes wrong, diagnosed with a health condition, or a family member is. You have a friend or yourself becomes an addict and needs to go into rehab. There's so many different forms. They're all forms of grief. And no matter what, to get through that, you need resilience, and you're going to have to battle through things and persevere. And then grace, you know, I joked, I didn't know really what grace was until this happened. And grace is just that inner light in you that refuses to go out. And it's tied to having a faith, I think, that there's something better, something out there that you can believe in, even though you don't have the evidence. But it keeps you focused and allows you to move forward. And that grace, though, is what connects you to your fellow human beings. And we all have it. It's this just internal light. When you do good for someone, you help someone out, you feel better. And you recognize that in yourself. So those two things kind of go together like salt and pepper at a kitchen table. You need both.
Empathy. I think of grace as being that. It is almost religious. You mentioned, talked about yoga before, and you know, the idea of the light in me acknowledging the light in you, and feeling for other people and recognizing that we're all part of something bigger. Yeah, it is it's funny. I wouldn't have said it had to be a religious idea, but I suppose it really is.
Yeah, I think it does kind of derive from that. And one thing I say in the book, and it's so true, is that the closer you stand to death, the more it can actually motivate you to feel alive.
Wow, that's another powerful one. I want to close by sharing with the listeners the amazing Helen Keller quote you shared in the book. Although the world is full of suffering, it is full also of the overcoming of it. And just let folks know, we have not even really scratched the surface of all the life wisdom that is present in the book Walk On. What's the best way? Is there a specific recommended way for people to purchase the book, Stephen, or is it a case of wherever fine books are sold?
wherever fine books are sold, but obviously it's available. It comes out April 16th. It's available now for pre-order on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. Online is probably going to be the most common way it's purchased. So Goodreads, IndieBound. But if it's not at your local bookseller, by all means, ask for it and or get online. And you can also visit stephenpanis.com, learn more about the scholarships, and there's links there to get to the book.
Really appreciate your time, your sharing, not just with us today, but on every page of this fantastic book, and just being so open about this journey you've gone on. You're going to help a lot of people, my friend.
That's the hope. We all need it, and we're here to help each other. So I'm just playing one small part. And thank you very much for having me on and helping spread the good word, Peter. And I look forward to talking horses next time.
Definitely. Thank you, my friend.
All right. Have a great day.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. Would like to thank Stephen Panis one more time, as well as Nick Tamaro. We'll thank our founding partners, 10 Strike Racing. Around here, we always love to root for the purple and black, as well as our charity partner, Therapeutic Horses of Saratoga, which is where Kim Weir is working these days, helping humans and helping horses. To learn more about Therapeutic Horses of Saratoga and their mission, and to give generously, go to inthemoneypodcast.com/horses. Most of all, though, would like to thank all of you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed today's show, got a lot out of, especially that conversation with Stephen. That was an intense one, but I really can't recommend the book enough. Walk On, wherever you get your books, online, or even better yet, in person. Support your local brick and mortar. Gosh knows they can use the help. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.